The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I paid for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
Ah, it's Friday! Yay! That's a good thing, because I could certainly use a weekend, and you probably could too. Things just get worse and worse in Trump's America. I don't know how else to put it. Look, on the Democratic side, we're not all progressives on the Democratic side. We have always had differences. And so to think that we'd all be united in our opposition to Donald Trump might have been a pipe dream. We are united in that one respect. We all want Trump gone, and for good reason. You don't need me to recount those reasons for you. But how we get there is what's at odds. And the ugliness that we saw play out in 2016 is back in force. And I frankly don't know the answer. Am I part of it? Absolutely. I'll tell you, social media brings out the worst in us. It's also a great thing. I'm grasping to find the right word for what it is. It has enabled. Look, I spent the greater part of my adult life working in California. I should say my favorite part of my professional career working in Los Angeles. I met some amazing people for 15 years. You know, I did radio in LA, and my social life and my work life were enmeshed. And when I left LA for a number of reasons, and it's a decision I'll look back on with many regrets in many ways. If not for social media, most of the people that I knew during those years would be lost to me forever because I had no way to stay in touch with them. I have a lot of friendly acquaintances throughout the years. Again, I live in South Florida now. I haven't been back to LA in a few years, mostly for economic reasons, not out of a lack of desire to visit. But even if I were going back without social media, I'd have no way to contact many of these people. And frankly, no communications with them at all. And so, look, I hate Facebook as much as anyone else. I think Mark Zuckerberg is negligent with his power and stature. I think he's hurting the country with the way he allows, for example, political candidates to advertise with no restrictions on no rule saying you have to tell the truth. At least with broadcast television, you've got to adhere to standards and practices. You can't openly lie, not that it doesn't happen in ads, but there are allegedly protections. On Facebook, there aren't. But for example, I posted a picture the other day. My old dear friend Mark Bonilla was in town. Mark Bonilla, again, I haven't seen or spoken to in over 20 years. He's an incredible guitar player. I met him back when I worked at KLOS, and he was the guitar player for Toy Matinee. And I became very close with him and Kevin Gilbert, who was the frontman of Toy Matinee. When I left LA, I lost touch with Mark Bonilla. Well, he messaged me out of the blue on Facebook and said, "Hey, I'm in your neck of the woods, touring with CTA, the new version of Chicago Transit Authority with their original drummer." And I got to see him on Sunday night or whatever night it was. I don't remember what night. One night this past week. All the days flow together for me. But it was great to reconnect with him. I adore Mark. And again, somebody that I totally lost touch with, but for the way to bring us together, social media. And then I posted a picture of us. And funny, a mutual friend of ours saw the picture on Facebook and messaged me and said, hey, you and I were on Rock and Roll Jeopardy together back in the day. Oh, my God. I won on Rock and Roll Jeopardy. It was only on the air for, I think, two or three seasons. It was on VH1. But on the Jeopardy set, it was hosted by Jeff Probst just the year after Survivor began. Maybe that's why they ended Rock and Roll Jeopardy. Anyway, I never got a copy of that. I never set up the VCR, which is what we had back in those days, to record it. And just a few years went by, and it's like, God, I want a copy of that show. I searched high and low for it, could never find it anywhere. It was before everything was uploaded to YouTube. It couldn't find it anywhere. For 15 years, I've been trying to find a copy of this episode of Rock and Roll Jeopardy. And because of Facebook, this guy contacted me. He's sending me his VHS copy. I'm going to digitize it and so we can share it with everyone. That's a little example. But so many people, friends from years past, I would never have any contact with them. And for that, I am grateful to the internet and to social media. However, it also brings out the worst in us. And I'm guilty. Look, I get sucked into these arguments. And I'm a passionate person. What can I tell you? And I've got a potty mouth, as you know, if you listen to the show. And I'm sometimes embarrassed by the way I come off on Twitter, more Twitter than Facebook these days. But hey, I've had my moments there too. So, it's nevertheless dismaying to see how we've devolved. Supposedly, we were going to be united against Donald Trump. And on that one front, we are. We all want Donald Trump gone. We just have differences in opinion on how we're going to get there. So yesterday, for example, I took Jason Johnson to task. I didn't mean to. Our friend Laffy posted something a tweet he sent out, and I responded to Laffy saying, too bad Jason Johnson, who is a commentator, a paid contributor on MSNBC, too bad he's turned into, I forget what I said, a troll and a, you know, Bernie hater or something to that effect. So Jason Johnson responded to me and basically said, what's your problem? And I said, what's your problem? You went on the air last night on national TV and said, quote, Bernie Sanders called Elizabeth Warren a liar on national television. That was an exact quote from Jason Johnson. Now, it's not a clip that MSNBC posted on their website, and I don't have it anywhere, but I saw it and I backed it up, and I should have taken a video of it because I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Now, I started tweeting something and then I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. Back away from the computer. And I did. But then yesterday morning, it came back to me when Jason Johnson, came back at me on Twitter and said, what the fuck are you talking about? And I said, you said, quote, Bernie Sanders called Elizabeth Warren a liar on national television. Please show me where he ever said those words. And if you can't, please apologize for what you said, because he never said that. Now, caught in a hot mic moment, we heard Elizabeth Warren asking Bernie Sanders, did you just call me a liar on national television? That was her take on it. He never said Elizabeth Warren is a liar, which is what Jason Johnson alleged. And I'm sorry, when you have a perch on a cable news channel and you're a paid contributor, you're an employee of that news organization, it's incumbent on you not to fucking lie. And so I let my emotions get the best of me and I called him out. I said, you're a liar and a troll. You lied. Show me. And then he got all, you called me a liar and a troll. Why should I engage with you? Well, you're engaging with me. Obviously, answer the damn question. And it escalated from there. But I'm not the only one. Look, I know I have a short fuse. I'm guilty. I'm Nicole Sandler, and I've got a lousy temper and I've got a potty mouth. And yes, sometimes I say things on social media that I probably shouldn't. But you know me. I'll own up to my mistakes when I make them, and I'll double down on things that I say when I believe them. So a little while ago, Tim Wise has been a frequent guest on this program for years. I've been a fan of his for years. But Tim Wise, who's on Twitter at, I think it's Tim Jacob Wise, I think is his handle, has gone off the deep end. I see Tim Wise tweets, "Happy birthday to John Lewis," or, as some Bernie supporters slash staffers think of him, quote, "that neoliberal shill who would, quote, throw cats under the bus for the DNC. Lewis did more for this country and human rights in a slow week in 1960 than they have done in their lives." So I called him out on it. I said, "Wow, Tim, you know I'm a big fan of yours, but making up heinous quotes and attributing them to Bernie Sanders are really beneath you. I implore you to stop slandering a good man who just might become our nominee." And oh my God, I didn't hear back from Tim, but from Bernie haters, you would have thought I said, "Your mother sucks cocks in hell." I did nothing of the sort. And then he doubled down on it again. I think he's lost it. I really do. In another tweet, let me see if I can find it. He said, okay, this is another one from just a couple hours ago. "Remember, you can't criticize Russia or Putin because, quote, what do you want? War with Russia? Do you want to destroy the world?" End quote. "And also, it's just neoliberal Russia phobia, unless Russians might be posing," in all caps, "as Sanders supporters to sow division, in which case, damn them." What? So I wrote to him again, "Tim, I had a meltdown a while back, for which I'm ashamed. I think you need to take a look at some of the stuff you're writing and perhaps get a grip. This isn't a good look for you." But this is where we are. It has devolved to this point, and I frankly don't know what the answer is. So I've had people, you know, "Oh, what did Bernie ever do for civil rights?" You know, sorry, I have work to do. Use the Google machine. Or, you know, you can listen to Robert Reich, who this just popped up on my Twitter stream, a video from Robert Reich, who was labor secretary under Bill Clinton.
Also, Rebecca Lynn, what do you say in response to Barney Frank saying that Bernie was ineffective in Congress? Well, actually, I was there. I mean, I was Secretary of Labor for some of these years. I saw how effective Bernie actually was. He was tenacious. He kept on getting changes, amendments, and very large pieces of legislation. His name was often not on those pieces of legislation.
Hello.
He did not have and does not have a huge ego.
Hello.
So he didn't hold out for his name to be highly placed on a piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. But he did hold out for amendments and for changes that almost in every case, not virtually in every case, helped working people and helped the poor. And I saw it again and again and again. He was an effective legislator, in fact, one of the most effective legislators, because the more you work behind the scenes and don't try to push yourself out there and don't try to get the limelight, the more effective you can be. Which ironically invites the complaint from some people that he was ineffective because he was not in the limelight.
Thank you, Robert Reich. Okay, so, you know, there's tons of stuff out there as to what Bernie accomplished. And as who just said it in the chat room, the Norwegian 76 said it's only harassment when Bernie supporters react to smears. The smears themselves aren't worth mentioning. And yes, he was known as the Amendment King because he got more amendments passed than anybody else in the House and the Senate, by the way. And yeah, so anyway, all that's going on. And oh my God, we're not even at Super Tuesday yet. So everyone, myself included, we all need to take a chill pill. But it's hard. A friend, someone I thought was a friend, has defriended David and me, my husband and I, because he, this blows my mind. He's a Russian immigrant. Yeah, from Russia, American now. He's got some weird views, but okay, everyone's entitled to their own. But he posted a meme, basically comparing Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump and putting up a graphic. What's my choice, Hitler or Stalin? Really? That cost a friendship. Because I'm sorry, that's bullshit. And he's echoing Trump's line and calling Bernie a communist? Fuck you. That will, not my friend, sorry. Anybody who is that ugly and that pejorative and that, you know, so judgmental without willing to look and see what he's advocating for. He's a communist? Someone who lived under, you know, Soviet rule? How dare you? So, look, I know emotions are high. We're all kind of freaking out. And I tell myself this, too. We need to tamp it down a bit. What I do to try to decompress from all this craziness is on weekends, you know, some of you know, I volunteer at the local animal shelter. Well, that's gotten me crazy, too, because I live in Broward County, Florida, and our shelter has been in the news a lot lately. And I experienced something on my own just a couple of weeks ago with a dog that I had found a home for, and the people were coming back up to adopt it, and the shelter put the dog down the morning these people came up to adopt him. For no reason whatsoever. Now, the shelter, according to them, is working towards being a no-kill shelter. And to be a no-kill shelter, to have that designation, you just have to be 90% no-kill. We're not even close. And this shelter is run by a woman who's in so far over her head, she may as well be, you know, drowning in the Everglades over here. She has no clue what she's doing. And they are indiscriminately, as far as I can tell, putting dogs down. So my stress level is rising. The thing I do to make me feel a little better, to help find these dogs home, is making me even crazier because I see how incompetent people rise to positions of authority for which they are not qualified. And I'm seeing, you know, friends, people that I knew from the past who, and this goes not only to friends, to other people, people who do not pay attention to politics, to the news at all for 3.5 years, come an election year, they're all of a sudden the experts and they know everything. And they're telling me why Mayo Pete is the best candidate and they have nothing to back it up. Back it up with facts. Or shut your mouth. And I know, look, everyone's entitled to an opinion and everyone's entitled to their votes. Just don't come at me like you're some expert. I live and breathe this stuff to my own mental health detriment. And when I see someone who doesn't have a clue spouting off and how Bernie's a communist, sorry, I'm going to get pissed off. And that's when I need a little funny. So before we get any further, this one, I like to, if you're new, I like to begin the day, each show, and we're already 15, 20 minutes into it, with something humorous, something that lets us laugh at the ridiculous, horrific position we find ourselves in. And this one actually was sent to me by a listener this morning, and the person who is singing is named Miss Lori Lehner, L-E-H-N-E-R. You can find her on YouTube. And here's one of her songs. Take it away, Lori.
Bill Barr's the fairy model of a bad attorney general. His intervening in the Roger Stone case is untenable. The way he does Trump spitting in the DOJ is horrible. His every move in lockstep with the king of the deplorables. Barr's very well acquainted, too, with making things political. His history with cover-ups is loudly hypocritical. From Mike Flynn to Andrew McCabe, he suffocates the rule of law.
Rule of law. Got it?
He must have graduated from the Betsy DeVos School of Thought.
He must have graduated from the Betsy DeVos School of Thought. He must have graduated from the Betsy DeVos School of Thought. He must have graduated from the Betsy DeVos School of Not Much Thought.
Barr won't work for the people's needs. He only serves the presidents. With love, they both be served with the just sentence and a residence. In short, his intervening in the Stone case is untenable. But Barr's a very model of a bad attorney general. In short, his intervening in the Stone case is untenable. But Barr's a very model of a bad attorney general.
Barr tried to hide the findings of the Mueller report with a note. Won't someone treat this poisoned institution with an antidote? Barr lied to Congress when they asked if he knew what Bob Mueller thought.
of his mischaracterization of Mueller's two-year report. Because Bill Barr diverted the grant funds from Catholic charities, the phrase hookers for Jesus entered in our vocabularies. Barr seems to interfere in legal matters where Trump is involved. He kind of looks like Patton Oswalt's evil twin, much less evil.
He kind of looks like Patton Oswalt's evil twin, much less evil.
He kind of looks like Patton Oswalt's evil twin, much less evil.
He kind of looks like Patton Oswalt's evil twin, but much, much less evolved.
He opened up a line from Giuliani to the DOJ to funnel funny Biden theories to the government.
You okay?
The clear criteria for Trump's license is being amenable. It's only been 1 year to Bill Barr's been attorney general. It sure is intervening in the Stone case is untenable. Bill Barr's a very model of a bad attorney general.
Yes, again, her name is Miss Lori Lehner. L-E-H-N-E-R. You can find her on YouTube. She's got other videos too. I'll have to check them out because that was very good. And she goes very fast. So that, you know, if you watch the video, they have the lyrics on the screen, which always helps when someone's doing a thing to a very major, modern, major general and a lot of words very fast. It helps if you can read along and sing along. I didn't do either. All right. Enough of my opining for now. We've got stuff. We've got news. And we've got a great guest coming up for you today. And just in time, as the Nevada caucuses are tomorrow, and we're already being warned to, prepared for the for it to be fucked up, as Iowa was. What a great time to speak with one of the country's foremost experts on election law, Rick Hassan. He was supposed to be here a couple of weeks ago. I had a screw up probably on my part in scheduling. He's on a book tour, got a brand new book out called Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. He will join us at the bottom of the hour. But before we get there, there's lots of news to talk about. Before we get to, we'll do the recorded version of what's news so I can get ready for Rick Hassan. Let me add to it. This breaking news just in, the jury deliberating in Harvey Weinstein's rape trial indicated that it's deadlocked on the most serious charges. The judge told the jury to keep working toward a unanimous verdict on all charges, but that's where it stands now. That's not good. There's something else, another sort of update to another story that I'll break in on the recorded What's News to update it, okay? So it'll be a hybrid What's News. Take it away, Nicole.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Longtime Donald Trump friend, advisor, and accomplice Roger Stone was sentenced to 40 months in federal prison on Thursday for obstructing a congressional investigation into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson had a few things to say before she handed down her sentence. Quote, "He was not prosecuted, as some have complained, for standing up for the president. He was prosecuted for covering up for the president." She also said, quote, "There was nothing unfair, phony, or disgraceful about the investigation or the prosecution." Adding, quote, "At his core, Mr. Stone is an insecure person who craves and recklessly pursues attention." I think that's pretty accurate. Stone reportedly showed no emotion while the sentence was read, almost appearing bored. He stared with his hands in his pockets and continually rocked on his heels, but he smiled creepily outside the Washington courthouse as he left. Stone will not have to report to prison until the judge acts on a defense motion for a new trial based on a claim of juror bias. Just hours after the sentence was announced, Donald Trump, of course, weighed in, saying, "I'm following this very closely, and I want to see it play out to its fullest because Roger has a very good chance of exoneration, in my opinion." Yeah. In other news guaranteed to make you sick, The New York Times broke the story Thursday afternoon that intelligence officials briefed House members last week on new information that Russia is already trying to interfere in the 2020 election to help Donald Trump win. Go figure. Aside from helping Trump get reelected, Russia is also trying to raise questions about the integrity of the election process, according to one of the sources. News of the briefing reportedly didn't go over well with Trump, who has repeatedly downplayed Russia's efforts to interfere in U.S. elections and has dismissed findings by U.S. intelligence agencies. The New York Times reporting further that a day after the briefing, Trump excoriated outgoing acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, for allowing the briefing to occur before the House Intelligence Committee, whose chair, Adam Schiff, led the impeachment proceedings against Trump. Reuters reported that a person familiar with the matter said Republicans on the committee, quote, went nuts and questioned the findings. Former CIA Director John Brennan explained how disturbing this all is on MSNBC.
I think there is tremendous concern that this just is a continuation of the trend that they have seen for quite some time. Donald Trump has been very dismissive and even disparaging of the intelligence profession and intelligence professionals and their products that they send to him. But it's one thing for him to ignore it. It's another thing for him to actively try to prevent the Congress from gaining access to this intelligence that is so necessary for the Congress to be able to do its job. So I think they see this as portending even greater efforts on the part of Trump to put his loyalists in these positions so they can squelch the intelligence that really is necessary for national security. And that's why I said this is a crisis.
I think you've worked for six presidents.
That's correct.
Three Republicans, three Democrats. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Never, ever. I didn't agree with a lot of the president's decisions throughout the course of those six administrations. But I never got the sense that they didn't want the intelligence community to do its work to the executive branch as well as to the legislative branch. But what we're seeing now is such an anomaly, such an aberration from what we have seen in the past about the importance of the independence of the intelligence community. Two nonpartisan national security professionals have been removed at the helm of the intelligence community. Joe McGuire and then Andrew Holman, who is a senior CIA officer who is serving as Joe McGuire's deputy. That is a virtual decapitation of the intelligence community. And now who is going in there? Someone who has no experience, no credentials, as far as the intelligence community is concerned, Richard Grenell. And so the intelligence professionals can only see this as yet one more example that they are not being allowed to do their job.
It just gets worse and worse.
It does.
Iranians
hold on.
Are voting
in parliamentary
elections on Friday.
Hold on.
It's
shut up,
Nicole. Let me just quiet myself. One other story. Jim Acosta from CNN just an hour or so ago tweeted, quote, "A source present for the intelligence briefing on Russian interference efforts said the information relayed to lawmakers made it apparent that Russia has already begun interfering in the 2020 election cycle. The source didn't get into specifics, but said it was clear Russian interference efforts are underway. Sure, it looks like it, the source said. Asked whether the information presented was alarming, the source responded, very. And Donald Trump, what does he do? He puts in one of his apologists as head of DNI and fires the career intelligence people heading the agency. This is a story you need to keep your eyes on. This is frightening. All right, back to me. Tensions mount both at home and abroad. It was barely a month ago that the U.S. and Iran were brought to the brink of war, thanks to Donald Trump. And a few months before that, Iranian leadership responded to anti-government protests over there with a brutal crackdown. Friday's election is expected to show how far the highest powers in Iran have moved from current President Hassan Rouhani's modernizing agenda in favor of more conservatives and hardliners. Lovely. All right, I'm interrupting myself because I'm not going to have time to play the whole thing. I had an extended What's News, but I used up all my time, and I want to get Rick Hassan on in a couple of minutes. They're also going to the polls in Israel on March 2nd, where a criminally indicted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is hoping the third time is the charm for him to stay in office. So what did he do? Announced new plans to build new settlements in part of Jerusalem that the international community holds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. The chutzpah, the balls on these people is just astounding. Come on, Israel, do the right thing. Coronavirus is escalating. The news is just ridiculous. And then, this. The White House acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, who, by the way, says the only reason he still got the acting title is because if he took the job, it pays $20,000 a year less than his other job as head of the Office of Management and Budget. I shit you not. Anyway, he privately told an audience in the UK on Wednesday that continued growth in the United States requires more workers and legal immigrants. Quote, "We are desperate," he said, "desperate for more people. We are running out of people to fuel the economic growth that we've had in our nation over the last 4 years. We need more immigrants," Mick Mulvaney said. Ugh, can't make this shit up. All right. I mentioned earlier that I was very excited about our guest today, that Rick Hassan, let me call him now, is the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at UC Irvine. He's a blogger at electionlawblog.com and author of a few books, including the brand new one just out, I think, last week, called Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick Hassan, thank you so much for joining us today. You there?
I'm here.
Ah, awesome. And
great,
I know,
to be with you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. I've been a follower of yours for a long time, and I've been wanting to talk to you. And when actually I saw that your book was being published a couple of months ago and put in a request back then to have you on when it came out. So the new book is out. Congratulations. I know you've been touring the country in support of it, and I know you're under the weather. So thank you, especially thank you for joining us today. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
And what precipitous timing as well. We live in what I think could rightly be called the disinformation age. So, again, I appreciate your efforts to set the record straight. And I know this is a really loaded question to get us started and one that I don't expect you to be able to answer, even if we took up the whole rest of this interview answering it. But I have to ask it anyway, because that is the question that I think you deal with in this book. Can we trust our election system here in the United States?
Well, I don't think there's a single answer to that question, in part because we don't have a single election system
uh-huh.
in the United States. Mm. You know, come November, we're going to see something like between 8,000 and 9,000 different elections being run simultaneously. So we don't even do it at the state level. We do it at the county or sub-county level. And it's kind of a mix of federal, state, and local law. Different kinds of machines, different sets of people who have different levels of training. I mean, just look at what's happened with the caucuses, where you had the parties running, the Iowa caucus and now the Nevada caucus. So, you know, we have to look for the places where there are vulnerabilities. In some places, things are in pretty good shape. In other places, they are more precipitous.
Right. And in fact, at the Election Law blog where you write, you have a piece today. The headline reads, "Election officials are already raising flags about Nevada's results." Doesn't engender a whole lot of confidence in the voting public, does it?
Right. And, you know, it's kind of unfair to generalize about the election system from the caucuses because those are run by political parties. And usually elections are run by election officials. But because these early contests are happening, everyone's focused on it. And, you know, the caucuses have a kind of they've had lots of problems for years, not just in terms of how they're administered, but in some of the unfairness in terms of people being able to show up in person and be able to participate. People who have to travel, who have to work, who have disabilities. Both Nevada and Iowa made some changes this year to try to make it more democratic, but it made the whole system much more complicated.
Right.
So in Nevada, they now have early voting in a caucus, which we haven't had before. They're voting the people who come early. They're ranking their top three candidates on a piece of paper that's going to be scanned. There are all kinds of questions about the scanners. And, you know, they were originally going to use the same company that made the app for Iowa. They don't want to do that now.
Yeah.
So now they've set up a phone line. And I just saw some information, maybe with up to 200 workers trying to get all this information in a quick time. And there's a lot of pressure to get it quickly. And I would rather them focus on getting it right.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think most of us would rather focus on that. You know, it was, I guess, in 2016, after the election, I have a Twitter friend in James Carter, who happens to be Jimmy Carter's grandson. And he and I had a back and forth conversation, and I sort of flippantly asked, why doesn't the UN send election, or why doesn't the Carter Center send election observers to monitor our elections. And he said, we don't even meet the criteria for us to do that, because, as you said, Rick, we don't have one electoral system. We've got hundreds of them around the country. So there is no way for them to monitor us the way we do other countries. Does that make sense?
I do think there is a room. There is room for people to go and monitor what's happening at the polls. It doesn't have to be the Carter Center or the OSCE. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be, you know, monitoring your local election officials, demanding transparency, making sure they're using voting machines that can produce a piece of paper that can be recounted, so we can have confidence in the system. I really do believe that people have more power than they think to demand that, at least in their local area, that there is some level of competence and some level of protection against those who might try to interfere with our system.
You know, so funny you should say that, because my local area, I happen to live in South Florida. I'm in Broward County, and we figure pretty prominently in your book, where it's just been...
That's right.
Yeah, we're on the internet, I can say it. It's been a clusterfuck down here. It's ridiculous, and you call out Brenda Snipes, look, who I think has done a horrible job as supervisor of elections, but it took Rick Scott, I think, to fire her, or Ron DeSantis, or whoever. I don't even remember anymore the order of events that happened. She was finally taken out of her job. I think the people should have voted her out. But the level of incompetency here in Broward County, one of the biggest counties in the state of Florida, one of the most blue counties in the country, it shouldn't have been so screwed up. And yet that's what we saw.
Right. And I think that, you know, if you live in Broward County, you're more likely to be disenfranchised by incompetent election administration than by Republican voter suppression.
Wow.
You know, there's so much focus on this voter suppression issue, which is a real issue. And, I've written about it and have a whole chapter in the book on it. It's a real thing. But, you know, there's no excuse for Brenda Snipes having been kept around where election after election, she engaged in activities that were, showing basic competence. And just to remind your listeners, in 2018, there was a recount of the, this was the Bill Nelson, Rick Scott, U.S. Senate race.
Right.
And they got the recount done in Broward County, but they were 2 minutes late in submitting their totals to the state. And so they were not counted in the official totals because the person working under Snipes did not know how to use the state website to put the totals in. And then, to make things worse, the county board believed that the recount was done in such a faulty way, it ended up coming up with about 2,000 fewer voters, that the county board voted to submit the original totals. I mean,
This
is somebody that Democrats should have primaried, gotten out of office a long time ago. And yet, you know, there are these pockets of incompetent election administrators in different places around the country, and it leaves an opening for people like Donald Trump, as he did, to claim that there was intentional wrongdoing by Brenda Snipes. There's absolutely no evidence of that. This is an illustration of what I call the book Hanlon's Razor. Don't attribute to malice that which can be explained by incompetence.
Absolutely.
She's clearly an incompetent election administrator.
Right. And that's probably what happened in Iowa as well. It was not malice, intentional malice. It was gross incompetence. Right?
Right. I mean, certainly that seems to be the issue. And then rather than being transparent, you may remember on election night, the Democratic Party issued a statement saying that there were, quote, quality control issues. You know, so rather than be transparent about what happened, they kind of hid it for a while. And then they started releasing numbers in dribs and drabs, and then they had to correct them because the numbers were not correct.
Right.
So, you know, really not the way you want a system to be run. And then, of course, you have people who are bad actors taking advantage of the situation. You had Trump's campaign manager saying this was evidence that the system was rigged, that the election was rigged against Bernie Sanders. No evidence of that. You had apparently posting of the phone number that precinct captains were supposed to use to call in their vote totals to the state party. You had that number put on 4chan and people maliciously calling the number to jam the phone lines. So when there is a problem of incompetence, it often creates an opening for either domestic or foreign actors to try to use dirty tricks to try to interfere with people's confidence in the process. And my book, Election Meltdown, more than anything, is about why trust in American elections is declining and what we can try to do about it.
Right. Now, Rick Hassan, you live in Los Angeles, where they've just, they're introducing a new electronic voting system. And, you know, what, I don't know if you know, you probably do know Brad Friedman, who's one of my dearest friends, who's been a longtime journalist working on issues of election integrity. And, you know, he warns people against saying you can't trust the system or you can't trust whatever to say we need to look at each specific thing. But he's also long warned about the dangers of many of these electronic voting machines. We saw the movie Hacking Democracy a decade ago, where we saw how easy it was to hack into some of these machines. Brad, I know, has been working a lot on this new system in Los Angeles, and, you know, advocates, as I do, for paper ballots hand counted. I don't know what why we can't do that. But people are just so up in arms and so invested and emotional about this, where I had somebody block me on Facebook who told me she's training as a poll worker for Los Angeles, and she's really excited about this new electronic voting system. And I said, you know, that's good that you're doing this. You should just be informed. You should check out Brad's blog and see what he has to say about it. And she got so angry with me for saying that this might not be the best system, that there are concerns, that she blocked me. Are we too emotional about all this? I mean, is this a concern?
Well, I do think people are very emotional about elections, and people are very concerned. The recent polling by NPR found that I think it was 41% of people are worried elections are not going to be safe and secure in 2020 for lots of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
On the specific question of the ballot, the new ballot machines in Los Angeles, I guess I fall somewhere in the middle. I think that they're a great improvement in a lot of ways over what came before, which was the Incavote system, which replaced the hanging chad system, you know, the old punch card system.
Right.
And, you know, it's got lots of great accessibility features for people with disabilities. It gives you a chance to see your choices on a screen that could be in your language. You know, there's lots of good things about it. It produces a paper ballot, which I think is good, and that paper ballot can be counted. It's not, you know, my gold standard would be optically scanned ballots, the kind where you fill in your choices with a number two pencil, like you're taking the SAT.
Right.
But I think compared to, say, a totally paperless system, I think this is an improvement. And I know that there are voting rights advocates who are very concerned about the barcode. And I'm more concerned about the barcode issue in a place like Georgia, where they haven't committed that a recount would be done using the actual names by human beings, you know, looking to see what name is printed on the ballot, but might just stick with the barcodes. I think that's a recipe for disaster. There needs to be some way of auditing. And, you know, it's a very robust debate between those who want accessibility and those who want ease of use of these voting machines, and those who are concerned about their security. And hopefully we can find some common ground. But I think there's a lot of concern, not just in Los Angeles, but in all around the country, where they're adopting these new ballot marking devices.
Sure. And here in Florida, I was here when we transitioned from the touchscreen ES&S machines, which were horrible, to an optical scan system like you're talking about, which is all well and good. But so you fill in the bubble, and you put the ballot through the machine, and all it says is, thank you, your vote's been counted. But it doesn't tell you how they registered your vote, so there's no way to know that it read it accurately. Even if it did show up on the screen, there's still no proof that it's registering it like that. So those who are paranoid or have a distrust for the way these machines work, I guess, have some, you know, ground to stand on. But then there was also a provision there was no provision for a hand recount should there be problems found. I don't know if they've since fixed that. I just know it doesn't engender a lot of trust in our system here in Florida.
Right. That's why I think we really need these risk-limiting audits. We need post-election audits to make sure that, you know, if they announce that one candidate got 52% and the other candidate got 41%, and you know, there's some other minor candidates, you should be able to do a kind of a random sample of those ballots, count them by hand, and make sure that they match. You know, there's a whole science behind this, you know, looking at statistics, and you can have a sense that these machines are whether or not these machines are accurately counting. The alternative of actually hand counting results, first of all, that would take a very long time, especially in a place like California where I am, where they vote on 50 or 60 things on the ballot. I mean,
right.
We have a very long ballot.
Yeah.
But also, the reason machines were introduced in the first place was because there was humans don't count as well as machines is number one, and there was more opportunity for fraud because, you know, literal ballot box stuffing and you know, ballots, you know, disappearing. So, you know, the machines were introduced for a good reason. I don't think we can fully trust the machine. That's why I think the compromise is post-election audits, so that we can have confidence that the vote totals that are announced by election officials match up with what's being reported by election officials as the results.
And it should be standard procedure, not just in the case of if someone raises a red flag. There should be audits to make sure that they're matching. You know, I have a problem with when I've heard recently, you know, the networks no longer report exit polling because we found that the exit polling wasn't matching the election returns, and they started futzing with the exit polls to make them match what the machines are spitting out. That's a red flag to me. Does that concern you?
Well, the problem with exit polling is that you don't have a random sample of people who answer the exit polls. There's nothing that requires someone who's voted to talk to the pollsters.
Right.
And if Republicans are more skeptical of media and they're less likely to speak, then the results could skew towards Democrats, even though there's nothing nefarious going on. Exit polls are interesting and useful for seeing general trends, like do people care about health care? Do they care about immigration? But in terms of using them as a way of verifying how people actually voted, they're a very poor tool for that. Much better tool is these post-election audits.
Gotcha. Rick Hassin is with us. His new book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. And you write that there are basically four reasons that our trust in the electoral process has deteriorated. And they make sense. So would you explain what those four reasons are?
Sure, right. So the book is asking, you know, why has Americans' trust in the fairness and accuracy of our voting system gone down? The first reason I talk about is laws that are passed mostly by Republican legislatures and Republican election officials that are passed in the name of preventing voter fraud, but in fact don't prevent any voter fraud, and instead appear to be motivated to make it harder for those likely to vote for Democrats to register and to vote. And I go through and I talk about a very important case that took place in Kansas where Kris Kobach, who's one of the people who you know, notoriously claimed that voter fraud is a major problem in the United States. He was actually forced to come forward with evidence of non-citizen voting in order to justify a Kansas law that required people to show their papers, their naturalization or birth certificates, before they could register to vote. He said the evidence he had produced was the tip of the iceberg. He had his chance to make his case, and the judge found there was no iceberg, just an icicle made up mostly of administrative error. And this push for these suppressive laws convinces both Democrats and Republicans that the other side's trying to steal the election. Republicans tend to believe that there's a lot of voter fraud going on, and Democrats believe that these laws are being passed to suppress the vote.
Yeah.
The second reason is the one that we talked about at the beginning, which is pockets of electoral incompetence.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, most of Florida's 67 counties could do a pretty good job counting the vote, but, you know, in a very close election, the attention is going to focus on Broward or on, you know, on these places that have history of maladministration in elections. And for those who are on the other side, so the Republicans who are looking at Broward County, they see incompetence and they're convinced that what's going on is actual fraud. And the president has been very vocal at making unsubstantiated claims of fraud. And so people who live in Broward or live in Detroit and some other cities that have Democratic majorities and poor election administration locally are hit with a double whammy. First, they're hit with poor election administration, and then they're falsely accused of engaging in voter fraud by the Republicans.
Wow.
The third factor, which we talked about a little bit in terms of Iowa, is dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Russian misinformation, the jamming of the phone lines that we talked about.
Right.
Even ballot tampering, which happens occasionally. We saw that in a North Carolina 2018 race. And then the final factor that I talk about is a rising incendiary rhetoric on both sides about rigged or stolen elections. And I think the more people describe or talk about elections as rigged, the more people are going to think that the system is, in fact, not fair, and it could be demobilizing and make people not want to participate in the process.
No, so yesterday, New York Times broke a story, another story, that Russia is once again already interfering in our election system. Of course, Donald Trump you know, poo-poos it. But what he did was fire the acting DNI who dared to brief Congress, the House Intelligence Committee, because, oh, my God, it's run by Adam Schiff. And so he's firing the messenger, in essence. He just says that's not true. It's not happening. I believe Vladimir Putin, because why would he lie? And should this impact how we think about our elections? Should we worry that the Russians are interfering, that our intelligence agencies are saying that they're interfering? Is this something we should be concerned
about? Oh,
absolutely.
Yes, it's certainly a worry. And I think it's not just going to be the Russians. It's going to be other outside actors, as well as actors within the United States who are going to emulate those kind of tactics, and actually talk about how Democrats tried to emulate some of those tactics in a 2017 U.S. Senate race in Alabama. And so I have a piece coming to Salon over the weekend about the question, should Democrats fight fire with fire when it comes to misinformation? I think actually not, because it's going to, even putting aside the morality of it, which I think it's immoral, it's going to be counterproductive and cause people to lose more faith in the system. We need to be on guard. And what we need is a president who would say to Russia or any other government that if you try to interfere in our elections, we're going to treat that as an act of war. And you need to have your hands off. And rather than have that, we have a president who publicly and privately dismisses the threat of Russian interference. And actually, I think, within the case of the Ukraine or the case of China or the case of Russia in 2016, actually invited foreign interference in our elections. And I find that extremely troubling. But Donald Trump is a symptom. He's not the disease. We had problems before Donald Trump, and we will have problems after he leaves the scene because of kind of the patchwork nature of our system, the hyper-polarized atmosphere we have in the country, as well as kind of shifting technology and the rise of social media, which makes things pretty, pretty tough trying to design a rational, fair system under these conditions.
Without a doubt. And you also point out, and you make a very good point, and look, it's we're all very partisan these days. I would do anything to get Donald Trump out of office. I also happen to be a very progressive liberal. My candidate of choice is Bernie Sanders. I would love to see him elected. But even if he were, there's only so much, you know, that he can do. But you point out in the book, Rick, that it's not only the Republicans who are guilty of dirty tricks. Your number one reason that the trust in our process has deteriorated. You say voter suppression has escalated at a GOP tool aimed to depress Democratic voter turnout. This is nothing new. There's a clip that I play. It's from 1980. Paul Weyrich, who is one of the founders of original guys of ALEC. This is what he very famously said. And we have to remember, this was 1980, if it wants to play, and it doesn't want to play. But he talks about good government syndrome, where they don't want everyone to vote, because the more people that vote, here we go. All right.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So this is, the Republicans play the long game. But the point I'm trying to make rather clumsily is that Democrats are not guiltless either. You mentioned, should we lower ourselves to their level and fight fire with fire? I want to see fair and free elections. And I guess that's what you're getting at in the book, is that's what we need to work towards and try to get rid of the scare tactics. I wonder how much social media has inflamed all that, though.
Yeah, well, I do think that, first of all, while I do say that Democrats have been guilty of some things, it's not symmetric.
No, I think
the Republicans have been far worse in terms of what they've been doing. And
they have.
While you're right that there has been talk about having a smaller electorate for a long time, it's, I think, as the Republican Party has become a whiter, more rural party, it's had to resort to more extreme measures. And thanks in part to the Supreme Court's decision in the 2013 Shelby County case, those jurisdictions that used to have to get federal approval before changing their voting rules no longer have to do that. So there is this, you know, eased ability to try to make it harder for people to put stumbling blocks in front of people so that they have a harder time registering voting. But our election system is broken far beyond that. And there are some things that we can focus on, like making sure we have competent people running our elections, like not spreading disinformation and cooling the rhetoric. And, you know, I'm very critical of Stacey Abrams when she claimed that her election was stolen, or when Sherrod Brown said that, because I think that when you use that kind of language, you're kind of ratcheting up people's expectations that the system is not fair. And I think that's ultimately demobilizing, that people don't want to participate in that system. And you end up having an argument about whether there's enough proof that the suppressive activities that were engaged in by Brian Kemp, who was the Secretary of State running against her and running for governor and running the election, whether that was enough to sway the outcome. And I think the focus should instead be on the dignity of each voter. We should ask, why does the state get to make it harder for any eligible voter to register and to vote? And I think that would be a more productive way. And that's really what Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight group is trying to do right now in Georgia, I think much more productive than having a debate about whether the election is stolen.
Right. But on the subject of, look, I would like to be able to say, you know, stop the rhetoric. Don't talk about elections being stolen. But I can't stop thinking about, you know, 2000 and Bush v. Gore, which I believe most of us would argue was indeed stolen. So with that, I mean, can we say, no, elections aren't stolen here, that we have to kind of trust but verify?
Well, I would not call the 2000 election stolen either.
Really?
What I would say was that the margin of error in the voting system far exceeded the margin of victory between the two parties. There was no way to tell who actually won that election.
Yeah.
And, you know, Republicans were very upset with how they saw the Florida State Supreme Court, made up of Democrats, changing the rules for how to conduct recounts. And Democrats, of course, were upset at the conservatives on the Supreme Court for changing the rules about, you know, when to end a recount. And, you know, everybody was, I think, motivated by who they wanted to win, including the justices. And, you know, I don't think it was necessarily anyone acting in bad faith. But when you have a lousy system and you have unclear rules and you have so much at stake, you know, I think it's probably expecting too much that even the Supreme Court can produce a result that most of the country is going to get behind. And I think it's only worse now if we came to it in 2020, because the Supreme Court is now seen as a much more partisan institution, with all the conservatives on the court being appointed by Republican presidents and all the liberals being appointed by Democrats.
Right. No, I don't envy I don't envy all of us. I frankly am dreading this election with each passing day, because it seems to get worse and worse. So final question for you, Rick Hassin. If 2020, we get a Democrat in office who says, Rick Hassin, I'm naming you our election czar. You overhaul the United States election system. What would you do to fix it?
Well, long term, I think we need to have national nonpartisan election administration, not have partisans running elections, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, have the same machinery, same rules around the country for our national elections, and, you know, try to use machines and voting systems that are auditable, that are transparent, and that people have confidence in.
Oh, that works for me. And you just audit them. You're not in favor of trying to do what they do in, for instance, England, who just had their elections. And I spoke to someone, and in every precinct, they have paper ballots hand counted. You think we're just too populous for that? Too many people here?
It's not just the number of people.
Oh,
it's a number of things
issues
on the ballot.
I
you know,
if
you're voting for judges and you're voting for 14 initiatives, you know, in Florida, you're voting for all these different things. It's just a lot to count. And I certainly favor paper, and I certainly favor audits. But I think hand-counted ballots is probably something that would introduce even more error into the system.
Gotcha. His name is Richard L. Hassin. At Rick Hassin is where you find him on Twitter. The book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to Democracy. You can get more information on it at electionmeltdown.com. And you can always read Rick's election blog at electionlawblog.com. Rick Hassin, thank you so much. As I said at the top, I've been reading your stuff for years. I'm a big follower of yours, a fan of yours. I so appreciate your time, especially knowing that you're not feeling well. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. You take care. All right. Bye-bye. Rick Hasson, everyone. Yes, you know I was looking forward to that for a while. And, yeah, he makes some really good points. I wish I knew how to get us to all tamp down the emotion, the outrage. Again, somebody that has been an acquaintance of mine for years blocked me on Facebook because I dared to say, when she was so exuberant about LA's new electronic voting system, read Brad blog. Listen to what Brad has to say. So she blocked me. We all need to have a bit more of an open mind. And with that, I wish you a very happy weekend. Go do something that makes you happy. Unplug from all this stuff. Go adopt a dog. All right. I'll see you Tuesday. Thanks, everyone. Bye.